Welcome to Center Maryland's The Lobby Podcast. We're really blessed with somebody special today. Is one of the freshest, newest members of the Maryland General Assembly, but at the same time, one of the most seasoned, really well-regarded, accoladed trial lawyers in the country right here. And that's our own West Baltimore delegate, Malcolm Ruff. Welcome to Center Maryland's The Lobby Pod, delegate.
Thank you, Damian. Much appreciated. I'm glad to be here with you and looking forward to chopping it up.
This thing will probably post, you know, within 2 weeks' time or so. Anything people need to know about your district? You want to talk about your district a little bit? Just, I'd love to give folks, before we get into your origin story, just anything sort of hot and pressing that you may want people to know that's going on in your district or with your legislative agenda.
Sure. Well, as you know, I'm a brand new politician. It's still hard to consider myself a politician because I've often thought of myself as a revolutionary. And so now I'm within the system. And but I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying getting to know all the people all throughout my district. And as you know, the 41st district in West Baltimore is very diverse. We, as you know, city, you know, Baltimore is a city of neighborhoods. Well, the 41st district is a prime example because you've got everything from Roland Park to Westgate and Ten Hills and everything in between.
Classic American urban neighborhoods of all kinds, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you got tremendous people all over. So I've just had a great time getting to know people in different community associations all throughout the district, getting to learn about different initiatives that are going, that are happening in the district. And I would probably highlight one of the things that's top on my priority list, which is the redevelopment of Pimlico, which is in the works, and the Maryland Horse Track Racing Authority will be coming out with a huge report on December the 1st, highlighting their recommendations and the path forward for renovating Pimlico.
That's got to be special for you in a way unlike any other. Weren't you raised in Park Heights?
And I grew up about 3/4 of a mile south of Pimlico Racetrack on Keyworth and Cottage Avenue.
All right.
And so I lived there my entire childhood with my mother and my brother. I remember all the hoopla around Preakness as I was coming up. But I actually didn't even go to Preakness until I was a little older and in college.
You weren't out there making money off the parking and doing any young entrepreneurial Preakness endeavors?
No, we weren't close enough to the racetrack to do anything like that. But I do commend the folks that made sure that they make a dollar every time the Preakness happens. And I think that's the point of the redevelopment of Pimlico, is that space needs to be a community hub. It needs to be a place that bridges the divide between Northern Parkway, over Northern Parkway, should I say, in Park Heights. It needs to bring people together from all different neighborhoods, right? It's kind of in the hub of many different neighborhoods. And the space has been dormant, I would say, for most of the year, for so many decades, except for Preakness and race days, which have become less and less attended. So what we're looking for and what we're expecting to see on December 1st from this report is a complete reimagining and re-envisioning of what that space can mean to the Park Heights community, to Northwest Baltimore, and to Baltimore across the board, because it will be a space that hopefully will have hotel and retail and community gathering space, playing fields. It will allow Pimlico to be accessible to the community, whereas right now, I think it's not being used to its fullest potential. And what I also hope that will do is bring an infusion of private investment, an infusion of into the economy of that business district, right? We're looking to make that a Main Streets designated district, and that's on the horizon as well. So big things on the horizon for my neighborhood, for Park Heights. I got so much love for 21215. I mean, it's where I was, you know, born and bred, and it nourished me. It propelled me to do the things that I'm doing today. And so I will be keeping my eye on that ball and focusing, making sure that that space gets revamped to the advantage of the community in Park Heights.
Such a central location right off 83. So much can happen there. You know, people come from all over to watch youth athletics or a concert or attend a conference. I totally get it, and I can't wait to see that. What's it like for a new delegate who grew up in the district? What's it like to get to work with a Professor Sandy Rosenberg? Talk to me. I mean, that's got to be really special. You guys are coming at this from two different worlds. Talk to me about that.
Absolutely. Well, I will first say I technically did not grow up in the 41st District. While I did grow up in 21215, and me and my wife bought our house. We made sure to buy our house in 21215. We're on the other side of the railroad tracks now from where we grew up. My wife also grew up in Park Heights as well, on Woodland and Laurel. And but we were just outside the district, just south of one of the southern boundaries of the district. So at the end of the day, I'm a West Baltimore boy.
Yeah, I mean, they change the districts, right? But
I mean, less than a mile, you know, from where we grew up. And so working with Sandy has been a pleasure already. I mean, he immediately, upon my appointment, you know, got with me, sat down with me, talked to me about the advice that he has, walked me through, you know, simple things like how to read a budget.
Right.
And, you know, how to count votes. You know, he's been doing this for four decades, and I have the utmost respect for him and for what his body of work is and his dedication to the office. As you know, he is the consummate delegate. And, you know, I appreciate how he has, you know, opened his arms to me and the delegation, along with the rest of my delegation members. You know, so much respect for Delegate Attar, as well as, of course, Senator Carter, who has been actually my trial partner in recent years.
Oh, wow.
We've actually worked on issues together from the courtroom to the legislature, fighting for the odor search bill last year together in Annapolis, which was kind of foreshadowing because at that time I didn't know that I was going to be throwing my hat into the ring to represent the district. But as my senator,
you're like, my senator is a force.
Right. As my senator, you know, there's not enough words that I can say for the people's champion and how much work she's done to move the needle for improving the lives, especially of Black and brown people in Baltimore City. Her justice reform efforts have been some of the most tremendous across this country, especially in 2021, all of the justice reform legislation that was passed and has been so transformative for police accountability. Which, as you know, is a huge issue and subject matter in my world professionally.
We're going to sneak into your origin story here because I had an interesting vantage point with you. I got to see you as a trial lawyer first, right? So I just got to see you be great, right? And so then I look, you know, I'm like, where did this guy come from? Oh, he went to Duke and he played football at Duke and he was a Gilman graduate, man. This guy's done it all. But right before Governor Moore appointed you, which was, I guess, a little bit of a pins and needles moment for you, right? I mean, you never know what's happened until it happens, right?
Absolutely.
I happened to be with our mutual mentor. He probably would be mortified when he hears I called him my mentor. But Billy Murphy's just the greatest human on the planet as far as I'm concerned, and I hold his judgment like supreme to all things. You know, he Absolutely. Was close with my grandfather, so for me it's like it's family advice or perspective when he's given it. And I was poking around about you and this appointment, you know, and he didn't want to let any cats out of the bag, but he said to me, Damian, I want you to know you guys are going to steal this guy into politics. this guy is an incredible, powerful, unusually gifted trial lawyer. And I get a little nervous that he's going to get swept away in the politics. So you had like the greatest trial lawyer in American history saying, that's great. The governor wants to make him a delegate, but please don't leave the law. This guy, Malcolm Ruff, is an amazing lawyer. So, I mean, how do you balance all that?
Well, I'm learning. I'm definitely learning. I mean, trust me, I've heard those same sentiments from Billy. And as you know, he's my OG. He is, my supreme mentor. I've had many mentors over the years and folks that have, you know, guided my path, watched out for me and helped me get over obstacles. But and when it comes to Billy, he's probably been the most influential mentor that I've ever had, the person I've learned the most from, and somebody that I just admire, try to emulate, and would hope to have even half of the success that he's had in his 52 plus years of practicing law. I am learning how to keep the balls all in the air. And, you know, I think there's something that I've been doing my entire life. It just, you know, when you raise your level, right, and when you up your game, the responsibilities are always going to become much greater. And I am very prepared to handle all of those responsibilities of representing the district while also ensuring that my clients have top-notch, highest level possible, zealous advocacy on their behalf. And it's because I'm so dedicated to the causes of our clients, right? I've been blessed to be at a firm, the Murphy firm, what we believe is the longest operating, continuously operating Black-owned law firm in the country. To be able to have cases and work on cases and find and have people find us that are dealing with violations of their civil rights, violations of their human rights, which is, you know, my namesake is Malcolm X, right? That's how I think I first got the inclination that I needed to work for people and my people and to fight for the rights of my people. I live in my namesake, right? And it just is nothing but God that has brought my path to a place where I'm able to, in this day and age, fight for the rights of people, and not just Black people, all people. We have clients of every shade and hue who have been done wrong, who have been violated, and need someone to go to bat against a much larger opponent than they would be able to face on their own. So it's the drive that's going to keep me, on top of all of the responsibilities of this office and of my law practice.
That's what people are missing if they're not in downtown Baltimore or working. You know, if you're not in downtown Baltimore, you don't get to run into Malcolm Ruff, your delegate and one of the most prominent trial lawyers we can find. You worked on the Jordan McNair case, big, prominent case in the Maryland public sphere, where, of course, the University of Maryland football player passed as a result of like a heat stroke. And there's tons of controversy over there. Anytime you're taking on a big institution like the University of Maryland, you know, it comes fraught with all kinds of interrelational aspects you got to deal with. I remember Mike Miller, the former Senate president, chastising the University of Maryland by saying, well, of course, if Jordan's family hired Billy Murphy, you guys are going to get it now. You're in trouble, you know. And so I hope, you know, I'm just saying this as an old man that's been watching Maryland politics for 25 years. I know your career grounds you, your community grounds you, and your representation, but I hope you feel confident that your legal education, your legal experience is going to be an extremely powerful tool in the Maryland House of Delegates. And to have somebody with your experience in medicine, they'd say it's clinical experience, so I agree, you're on the ground, you're going to be a real clarion of trust and responsibility when it comes to public safety, or anytime, you know, regular people are getting pushed on upon by bigger, powerful forces. And I just want to encourage you to pay into that, man. That's going to be a powerful, powerful thing.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you saying that. And that's exactly what I intend to do. You know, I intend to draw on all this experience. I've been practicing now for 11 years, which blows my mind. You know, it feels like I was just in law school a couple of years ago. But I have put together a substantial body of work. You know, of course, being with the Murphy firm for the past 6 years, that'll give your career a nice little boost if you're able to tackle the tasks that are at hand. But, you know, even my experience as a criminal defense lawyer, which was my bread and butter when I came out of the prosecutor's office, you know, I think will serve me well and will allow me to bring a very unique and, authoritative perspective to a lot of the issues. You know,
Not to interrupt, but
no worries.
You know, you've done Baltimore City State's Attorney, you've done Baltimore County State's Attorney. You know, there's a world where people come out of those without going to the other one. It changes their worldview, or it shapes their worldview. You being in both places, you're going to be able to cut through all the differences and nonsense and get to some real commonalities, I feel like, from that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, you know, every jurisdiction is different. So it was also good to have the experience as a criminal defense lawyer, being able to go to so many jurisdictions. I think there's only 8 counties in the state that I haven't been in a courtroom practicing law so far in my career. And most of them are, you know, far western Maryland or, you know, far southern eastern shore. It's great to be able to see the different types of issues that people are facing in the different regions of the state. And I'm certainly will bring that experience to the legislature as well. Maybe at some point I will find my way to the Judiciary Committee and be able to weigh in there. But I'm glad to be serving with the Legislative Black Caucus, a tremendous group of legislators, a lot of them lawyers, a lot of them very experienced in public service. And I've been asked to be a part of the Criminal Justice Reform Group and subcommittee. And so we've been meeting on a regular basis, and we've been talking about everything from expungement to police investigation of police-involved shootings and serious injuries. And I think that that's really a place that I'm going to be able to weigh in to begin with. And you know, I'm a freshman delegate. I've gotten a lot of advice about how to get started. I'm doing a lot of listening. I'm doing a lot of learning. I'm doing a lot of observing. But you will gradually see me become way more active and start to stretch my muscles, right? And to use my experience to really make a substantial contribution to the way we formulate our laws and how they interplay with the lives of everyday people.
I got to play football at Gilman as a Mount St. Joe Gael.
Well, I'm so sorry.
Sorry is the word for my football career, but man, it was a special feeling walking onto that campus. When did you get started there? How did that all happen? Your story reminds me a little bit of Bob Ehrlich's story. Another big Maryland politico who sort of went across town from Arbutus to Gilman. You made the trek from Park Heights to Gilman, which is not too far, but the two different worlds, like you talked about. Love to hear about that experience.
That's so interesting you should say that. Two different worlds, exactly the topic that I wrote on in my law school entrance admissions essay. It was about watching the dichotomy of coming out of Park Heights and coming down Shirley Avenue and seeing, you know, dilapidated homes and open air drug markets and crossing 83 and, you know, hitting Roland Avenue and the whole world changing. It was something that really weighed on me as a child to think about, you know, the people in my neighborhood didn't deserve to be in this environment, right? There was nothing inherently different about the people in my neighborhood versus the people in Roland Park.
Right.
who had tree-lined streets and pristine lawns and Victorian million-dollar homes. And that's something that also drove me to be a warrior for justice, right? And to look, work on how can I level the playing field for all people. But as far as my Gilman story goes, my family actually has been a part of the Gilman community since 1967.
Wow.
Yeah. My mother's brothers, her two younger brothers, attended Gilman, my uncles, one who graduated in 1971 and one who graduated in 1978, William and Stanley Ruff. And that was
1971. They probably graduated with Hassan, right? That's a big joke. That's sorry. That's for Hassan Murphy.
Just I can't even. You know, I'll give him a chicken wing every now and then, but I can't even let you do that to me. So 71, 78, and as you might know, the one of the consummate headmaster at Gilman for many many years was Redmond Finney. And he made the intentional decision to go into neighborhoods, into Black neighborhoods in Baltimore back in the 60s to find young Black men who would be able to handle the curriculum at Gilman, but also would be some of the first Black students. So my Uncle William was one in the third class of Black students to graduate from Gilman School. And,
fantastic.
And so it just went from there. My mother actually, when I was born, decided she was going to get a job at Gilman. And I know she intentionally did that to make inroads for me to get into school there. So I started at Gilman at first.
Yeah, you had the G on your chest from before you came out of the womb.
I literally was on Gilman's campus. I've been on Gilman's campus since 1986. I was 2 years old. My mother was the first Black librarian in the elementary school at Gilman.
Awesome.
And so she was there for a couple of years until I got in. And then my younger brother also attended Gilman after me. And my brother-in-law actually graduated from Gilman in 2011, I want to say, or 2013.
Are you too young to cross paths with Nick Schloeder?
Which one?
Oh, all right. All right. Fair. I just went to a Grateful Dead show with the youngest.
I believe
Bob talking about the granddad, I think, the famous.
I did. I knew both of them, but my uncles actually were coached by him.
Wow. And they called him coach, right?
Correct. Correct. And my son actually now is a third grader at Gilman, and he will likely, I believe, be the first third generation African-American student to graduate from Gilman.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, one day I'm going to take your Duke Gilman self over for a tour of Mount St. Joe. I just brag how I know you. So if you could play, if you could play along, you'll love it.
I've never actually been in any of the buildings. I mean, I've been on the campus, obviously, to play games, but never been in the buildings. And I had a cousin, my closest cousin, who was the same age as me. We graduated the same year, went to St. Joe, played basketball there. But I just never had a chance to actually tour the place. So I'm going to take you up on that.
All right. I got you.
Especially
thank
since
you.
They're in my district.
That's right. Hey, and thank you so much for going to Father Mike and Archdiocese and St. Agnes's gun buyback and the launch of their St. Agnes Mobile Health Unit. Delegate Ruff's like, this must be the commercial messages part of the show.
That's all right.
No, but man.
That's a good message to get out there.
Yeah, you know, I tried to talk Father Mike out of it. I'm like, you know, these gun buybacks, Father Mike was right. Pulled 356 guns off the street, like 30 of them were semi-automatic. It was 20% of the BPD's total annual haul. And then the better part was all those, you know, Life Bridge over there from Park Heights, Ascension St. Agnes from Irvington were all there, you know, providing so much more for the community. And you being there means a lot. And us being able to get you there a couple of months after you were appointed made us feel good. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate the invite. I thought it was a tremendous event. I think it will make our streets that much safer. But we also have to be more intentional. You know, I've talked to officers who have said, you know, we have to be even more strategic when we are looking to do an event like that.
That's right.
And while it's awesome that we got, you know, almost 400 guns off the street, we need to get the right kinds of guns off the street. We need to get the right kinds of people to bring those guns and to lay them down and to give them up. Because, you know, if we don't get these ghost guns off the street, if we don't get handguns off the street, we're going to continue to see the type of, you know, unfettered violence that we've been seeing. And I know crime is down and shootings are down, which is always a great statistic to be able to quote. But the culture of violence in our city is at a different level than we've seen it before. And we really have to figure out how to take the streets back, right? We've got groups out here like We Are Us and Safe Streets and folks that are in on the ground, you know, touching and agreeing with folks that we really need to prevail upon to know that violence is not an answer to any problem that's out there.
Yeah, what that event showed to me was like more than the gun buyback. And you're exactly right about the intentionality. I want to ask you about that. Let me just get right to the intentionality. One of the difficult balances is like the desire of people to in the community to want to do something. And then, you know, sort of the policy of balance of like, well, let's make sure they're doing the exact right thing. Or let's make sure if there's all this energy that it's going to do, you know, that it's optimized, or, you know, and sometimes that balance creates a moment where people are like, oh, I want to do this, but doesn't fit. So then I'm just going to do nothing. And I felt like the thing that does to communities is like great mayors and elected officials like yourself know that part of half the battle is when you get community people that want to get engaged, you got to find places for them to get engaged, right? You want them to be in the right places. So talk to me a little bit about that intentionality versus, you know, good being the enemy of the perfect or something like that. Like, do you understand what I'm saying? There's like, especially for outsiders or people that are offering themselves to the community, you know, we don't want to be ham-handed. We want to be useful, but we also feel like sometimes there's not a connective path to get to that point of service that Governor Moore wants us all to be a part of.
Well,
it wasn't very clear there. So do what you can with that.
I think you're right. It's a very fine line to walk, right? But I think the utmost priority is about empowering the members of the community and moving the ball forward. So I think that the option of doing nothing is not an option. That's never an option, right? We always have to be moving forward. We always have to be figuring out how to give the community tools, right? And the ability to be independent, right? The ability to help from the inside, from the ground, from the grassroots. And, you know, when I talk about being intentional about something like a gun buyback, I think it's about looking at the types of issues that are out there, the specific types of threats that are out there, right?
Yeah.
For instance, in that gun buyback, you know, of those guns that were recovered, there were a lot of rifles, right? A lot of hunting rifles,
right?
And that's not; those aren't the guns that we're seeing.
That's right.
On the streets that are causing this type of
and might not even be used in a home, you know, of self-violence or something, might not even be applicable that way, you know.
Right. So, you know, while I am clear that getting those guns off the street, allowing people to get some money for turning those guns in is going to push the ball forward, right?
Right.
We want to have maximum impact because that's what these communities deserve. And if we're going to give out $50,000, we need to make sure that we're focusing our attention on those folks that are going to potentially cause.
I think that's a great critique.
Yeah.
You know,
critique.
It is constructive. No, like we started with the gun buyback and then it became a gun buyback and resource fair because the feedback we got was like, hey, we need more than that. And so I wonder the next one, you know, does it just become a resource fair or how do we, How do we optimize the gun buyback? Or how do you just take all that positive energy and then perfect it into a better place for the next event? So I think that's why we're on the phone today.
Yeah, I don't think you go away from a gun buyback, right? Yeah, I think it makes sense to give people amnesty in the good of getting these dangerous weapons off the street. I just think that there's a way to use the expertise of our law enforcement agents to figure out how to be more pointed about getting the right That's folks right. to actually say, okay, I see what's happening here. This is an opportunity for me and to do the right thing without, you know, any harm coming to me as far as potential criminal penalties and punishment. So that's just, I think we lean more the next time on what law enforcement officers and those high ranking officials believe is the best path forward to getting the most dangerous guns off of the street.
Feeling it, hearing it. I got it, man. Last thing I wanted to point out is you're working downtown. You know, I can't, and you're in the One South Street building, so I can't let this go. Yeah, can't let this go.
Love it, man, because we're on the top floor.
Yeah, man, it's a beautiful building. And then they're coming with all kinds of new services and interior design, air services, cool. Talk to me, what you big trial lawyer. That's what my granddaddy was downtown, being a big trial lawyer downtown. What's that like with the Orioles winning and the Ravens going well? Talk to me about what's been happening recently there in downtown Baltimore. You got a little bit of a renaissance going into West Baltimore. It seems like you're bringing it to downtown Baltimore as well.
Well, yeah, it's about time, because COVID just about turned downtown Baltimore into a ghost town. And it was really rough coming into the office and seeing businesses shuttering their doors. You know, we lost a couple of restaurants in the center part of downtown near the courthouse. We're about two blocks from the courthouse. But you're starting to see the revitalization in downtown. I know you talked about West Downtown, the Howard Street corridor. It's starting to blossom. A lot of black women-owned businesses popping up there and thriving.
The mayor's got his Boost program, which is specifically designed to try to get black-owned businesses downtown.
Absolutely. And then you got my buddy Chris Janian, who is building up the Roma Seltzer Arts District.
Right below my Park Avenue.
Yeah, he's creating that hub between Mount Vernon and Howard, which I think he's going to do a tremendous job with that.
We could always use a little more Chris Janian in Baltimore, don't you think? Yeah. He delivers the goods.
You know, he's a brother of mine that I think is just got great vision, right? Yeah. And when you have a great vision, you can't help but implement it. And he's got the tools to do that too. So, and what else you got? What else am I missing?
Hippodrome. I mean, you only had David Chappelle down there. You know, you got your buddy, the governor of the state of Maryland, is soaking people down in right field, you know, on national television. I'm seeing it from San Francisco or Colorado. It's pretty cool.
Man, I used to sneak a little handheld radio in my bed when I was in like middle school and listen to Fred Manfred and John Miller over the radio waves every night, just listening to the Orioles, Chris Orioles and Mike Devereaux and all my guys, Gomez, of course, Cal Ripken. I just loved the Orioles since I was a kid, and just so great to see them thriving again. And that has revitalized downtown. I mean, you know, much more traffic. You know, you'll go through downtown now at night and there's traffic.
CFG Arena, right?
CFG is doing a big thing. I got a chance to check that out as well. The Aquarium's got some development going on.
John Racanelli, great leader.
We actually have a new restaurant right across the street from One South Street, the Empanada Lady.
Nice.
Another young black female-owned business that's right there. So I get to pop in there a lot on occasion. And, I think downtown is back on the rise. You know, the One South Street building, I think we just got new ownership, and they're working to, even increase the tenants in that building. I think we're over 80% occupied building. Beautiful. At this point. And it's a great building. So, yeah, you know.
I mean, you could just do an interview series with the people that work in that building between you and Billy and Goodell DeVries and Steeples in there, right?
Brother Quinn is in that building. And
Right.
Why am I blanking on their name? Oh, my goodness. I'm blanking on the name, but my guy Justin Red, also a Gilman guy, is at that firm as well.
Well, you're going to have to invite me over so we get some purple in there, get some more St. Joe influence over there.
Come on over, man.
Delegate Ruff, you've been
to have over. You in the penthouse.
That is nice up there in the penthouse. It's a beautiful view of Baltimore.
Beautiful.
Can you, any last words, any last thoughts you want to share with our audience before we let you get back to the work of the people?
No, man. I think one other thing I will say is that a big thing that I'm keeping my eye on, and everybody should be keeping their eye on, because I'm sitting on the Transportation and Environment Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee for the House of Delegates.
You found the money quick.
Yeah, you already know. Somehow, I've been told it is a very positive appointment to get as a freshman. It's very rare. But Tony Bridges, who I replaced, I stepped into his shoes after he was
great talent,
appointed as the Deputy Secretary of Transportation for Equity. And I shout out to Tony. That's my man. And he gave me his blessing to try and replace him. And
what a bright light.
Got the whole thing started. But he was on the Appropriations Committee. So I was able to step into his position. But the red line. It is imperative that we get it right. It's imperative that the state makes the investment that they've made in other areas, specifically the Purple Line. You know, if the state is willing to invest millions and millions and millions of dollars into improving the transportation, the public transportation methods in the suburbs of D.C., the state needs to be willing to do the very same for Baltimore City and its surrounding area. And
well said.
For us to be able to get east and west for the first time, since forever, would be, a huge improvement to, the lives of all people, as far as work is concerned, as far as play is concerned, as far as the economy is concerned, getting jobs. And specifically, I'm talking about making sure that we get a light rail system, right? I think it would be really, really negative if we had a bus rapid transit system.
If it was the most teched out version, just feels like you're giving the heavy rail, the light rail to the DC region, and then we get like the painted lines and the buses.
Right. I mean, look, we just spent another 145 some odd million dollars to keep the Purple Line on track, right? If we're willing to make those sacrifices for the suburbs of DC, we got to be willing to make the sacrifices for Baltimore. And I know money is going to be tight. I know that our state budget is going to be much less substantial than it has been in the past couple of years coming out of COVID and with all that money that's been infused from the federal government. But this is not an option. This is something that has to happen in order for Baltimore to lead the state, as the governor has talked about. And so as goes Baltimore, so goes the state. And that is nothing but the truth. We're the most populated city in this. We have the people that have the biggest needs in the state. And if we're going to meet those needs, they need to be able to move throughout the city seamlessly, with dignity, with grace, and with as much ease as possible, and as least costly as possible. So I'm a huge proponent, and we'll be, speaking up to make sure that the red line serves Baltimore City most effectively.
He's Delegate Malcolm Ruff. Now you know why he's one of the best in the land, in the law. Now he's representing the people of West Baltimore. And today we made you, we put you in charge of the people of downtown Baltimore. Thank you for that as well.
That's all right. I appreciate it, man. And I really appreciate the invitation. I want to shout out to the 41st District, to all the folks that have, opened their arms to me, the community association leaders, all the folks in the communities, the schools that I've been able to touch with. And I'm looking forward to fighting for you guys and continuing to improve the lives of West Baltimore citizens.
Thank you, Delegate Ruff. You're the man. Thank you. Thank you.